Does cybersecurity seem like a terrifying topic? Well, have no fear. This episode is sponsored by Roundtable Technology, the nonprofit IT partner. For the 8th year in a row, they are offering a free webinar to teach you and your staff exactly the steps to make your IT more secure in the new year. Head over to nonprofitit.com/best-ever to save your seat. Roundtable Technology is a managed IT and cybersecurity services organization focusing almost exclusively on the nonprofit sector with over 200 nonprofit clients. So make it your New Year's resolution to get your entire staff free cybersecurity awareness training. Go to nonprofitit.com/best-ever to save your seat now. And here's to a wonderful 2024. Hello, and welcome to Nonprofit Nation. I'm your host, Julia Campbell, and I'm going to sit down with nonprofit industry experts, fundraisers, marketers, and everyone in between to get real and discuss what it takes to build that movement that you've been dreaming of. I created the Nonprofit Nation podcast to share practical wisdom and strategies to help you confidently find your voice, definitively grow your audience, and effectively build your movement. If you're a nonprofit newbie or an experienced professional who's looking to get more visibility, reach more people, and create even more impact, then you're in the right place. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Nonprofit Nation. Welcome back. I'm so thrilled to be here with you today. I'm Julia Campbell. I'm your host. And our topic today is a brand new one for me. It's how to apply human-centered design thinking for incredible results. Now, if you haven't heard of human-centered design, it's built on the idea that people who experience a challenge are best suited to solve it. And I think it's a really interesting topic, and I can't wait to dive in. So my guest today is Vishi Jagannathan, co-founder and executive director of the Rural Opportunity Institute. So the Rural Opportunity Institute is one of 8 organizations in NewProfit's first health equity cohort that supports youth organizations and communities in rural North Carolina to help them interrupt the cycle of generational trauma and design innovative solutions for healing and resilience. I love that Rural Opportunity Institute, ROI, works to turn wisdom and the newest science into common practice. And in this episode, Vishi shares the path that led her to start the organization and how, when properly resourced, a rural community can become a hotbed of innovative practice. So welcome, Vishi.
Yeah, thank you. I am excited to be on.
Yes, I'm really thrilled to have you. So let's talk about your journey and how you founded this organization.
Yeah, so it's definitely not the most direct path. So I started ROI with my co-founder, Seth, in 2017. So it's been a little over 6 years. But that definitely wasn't the vision from the start. So I actually, my parents are both immigrants from India. And so I was born in New York and grew up in that area. And they both were scientists at IBM, like my whole life. And so I got exposed to science and engineering at a pretty young age and decided I wanted to study that. So had my heart set on kind of working in tech and majored in engineering, graduated right into the financial crisis recession in 2010. And it was just super hard to find a job in that field. And I didn't really have a backup plan. And so ended up pursuing graduate school to just kind of give myself more time. And I was at Stanford. It was like in a dream PhD program. And pretty quickly just didn't see myself reflected in most of the people in the field. Like probably more than 90% men in my class. I mean, even more than that among the faculty. I just didn't feel like a strong connection. And so I was in a confused place And that's usually when the Teach for America recruiters show up. So I happened to meet a TFA recruiter.
Yes.
And they were very compelling. And so I ended up leaving the PhD program to do TFA.
Wow.
And I got placed in rural Eastern North Carolina, which I had never been to the South before. I had never been in a rural community. What I expected was to be close to like Duke and UNC basketball and things like that. And I just remember driving cross country with my dad, like passing Duke and everything on the highway. And the GPS said like 2 more hours. I was like, where are we going? And yeah, ended up in Northampton County, which is like right on the Virginia border, very rural. But it was really powerful for me. Just is probably one of the only places I've ever lived where I felt super connected to people and very welcomed. And at the same time, it was like my students, their families, the other teachers, everybody had connections to the place that went back many generations. And for my family, we don't really have deep ties to anyone in the U.S. And so that felt super different to me.
Mm-hmm.
And what was probably most striking was that people were really connected. There were these deep roots, and I saw a lot of major disparities, racial disparities, urban rural disparities, wealth disparities among the same families. And it didn't really connect with the stories I had learned in school about how like slavery and racism and all that stuff is over. Everybody's equal. Like I still saw a lot of vestiges of that. And started to kind of lose trust in a lot of our traditional educational institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And that led me on like a very different path of wanting to get closer to communities and understand their stories directly from them. Because I think a lot of the stories that we get from other sources have a lot of bias, and they often like blame communities that struggle rather than recognizing that maybe it's systems that are causing a lot of the challenges. So all that to say, I never went back to grad school or tech, got really motivated about learning more and more about the actual history of communities like Eastern North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And along the way, met Seth, who is now my co-founder, and he also did TFA in the same region.
Oh, and, wow.
Yeah. And so we just connected on a lot of the same things. He also wasn't from the area.
Where is Seth from?
Iowa.
Oh, wow.
His parents, I think, worked at the University of Iowa. So he also had never been to Eastern North Carolina, but had a similarly powerful experience. He always says it's the first place that really felt like home to him. And so we were just kind of enamored by the place. And after teaching, we both ended up moving to the Bay Area, San Francisco, for different jobs and reasons. But while we were there, it was an interesting tension because there were a ton of cool, innovative practices and resources being used. One of them is human-centered design thinking. And yet in every room we were in, people were not understanding or talking about places like Eastern North Carolina.
Right.
And so after a while, we kind of put our heads together and said, what would it look like to create an organization that was rooted in rural that connected the people that we already know to be already there with some of these innovative tools? And if we did that, what types of solutions could we create that might lead to outcomes that up until now, rural communities haven't been able to access? And that became eventually the vision that we used to raise some money to start ROI.
Mm-hmm. So you're an expert in applying something that is called human-centered design thinking, and applying it in rural communities. So for my listeners, like, what is this kind of design thinking and how can they start using it?
Yeah, so at its core, the idea behind human-centered design or design thinking is that a lot of times we make an assumption about the problems or experiences of the people we want to build products for, and we go ahead and create something, but then when we try to give it to people, it doesn't work how we thought, it doesn't really solve their problem, they don't really like it. And so the roots of design thinking are actually in like corporate product design around focusing on understanding the people and the problem you're trying to address before coming up with any solutions. And so it's been used historically to do things like design toothpaste or shopping carts or different products we use every day, the way that they're set up isn't something that someone just came up with in their head. It's like from observing and watching people how solve problems on their own, you can start to say, oh, okay, this is something that would help them. Only recently it's become more prevalent in like social innovation spaces, but we've found it really useful to do the same thing. Like a lot of times I think nonprofits come up with programs that definitely help people, but they're not fun or easy to use. And so we spend a lot of money creating something and we say, this is great for the community. How come nobody's coming? But really,
yes, we do.
Yeah, it might be that it's not in a convenient location, or we didn't consider, you know, how people are going to get there or what else they might have going on at that time.
Noon on a Wednesday and everyone has to work.
Exactly. And so this, it's not super complicated, but basically the idea is you can understand people's constraints first before designing those programs by doing things like interviewing folks, observing what they currently do instead, offering different options and having them give feedback on what they'd most prefer, even like testing things in a small way. So maybe having multiple time options at first and then seeing, okay, which one do people most often come to? Let's go with that. So it's really just this idea of trying to really understand what will work for people before we invest a lot of time and money and resources into launching something that nobody's going to show up to.
Absolutely. And we talked before we hit record about how I had served in the Peace Corps, and there are a lot of correlations between the Peace Corps and Teach for America. And actually, when you are in the Peace Corps, at least my experience, I think a lot of volunteers' experience, you spend a full year just doing research on the ground. It's very hard for a type A person like me that wants to come in and solve all the problems and do all the things and raise all the money and build all the buildings. But it is so important, because if you don't have that understanding of the community that you're in and the buy-in and the trust, those things are hugely important. And if you're just coming and sort of putting your own experience and lived experience, what you know, onto a completely different culture and community, it's not going to work. And I saw a lot of volunteers get very frustrated by that. I'm sure you saw that as well. And I just think that I think many more organizations could benefit from this, even though I do think for a lot of my listeners, I mean, we are kind of entrenched in the work that we do. We're not really starting from scratch. So that brings me to a really great article. You were featured on the Teach for America website. I'll link to it in the show notes. It's all about your work, the people you work with, and it showcases how you center this particular community in your work. So what advice do you have for nonprofits, some who might be resistant or board members that are resistant? How can we get better at centering our own communities, like in the change that we seek to make?
Yeah, that's a super great question. And I think, yeah, I just wanted to lift up or appreciate the comment you made about a lot of times those of us doing nonprofit work, we are already entrenched or part of the community. And so it can seem really daunting to do something like this. But I think actually it's like just building on the infrastructure you already have, the relationships you already have. Like in order to be able to do this work, you usually already have to be kind of plugged into some folks. It's more, I think, a question of being intentional and systematic about community engagement. It's like we're already doing it, but when is it working and how do we make that more of our process? So a couple of examples of things that we do that could be helpful. We have a community accountability board. And so similar to your formal board that you have quarterly meetings with, you're expected to come prepared with certain things. And there's this, like whether you like it or not, there's always going to be this opportunity to engage. We have a similar parallel community board, and that's folks that were nominated by other residents who have specific on-the-ground experience with the types of things. In our case, trauma-informed work, sort of specific on-the-ground experience with that. And we also meet with them quarterly. And so they are coming to the table. We are expected to present, programmatic plans and goals. They weigh in on things. They have decision-making authority. They cast votes on what we should do next. And so even if nobody stops to think of like, oh, we should ask community about this. It's like a built-in thing. We don't have to think about it. We have that quarterly meeting just like our regular board. And it wasn't, you know, it's not that much extra effort to spin up. So that's one, like creating structures like that, I think make it less of a thing you have to remember or another to-do list and just a part of your process. Similarly, we do monthly open listening sessions. And these are now like hybrid or virtual because of COVID and everything. And so we just send out in our newsletter. It's like the same time of every month. There's an hour long space. Anybody can come to it. And we usually present a couple of open-ended prompts or key issues that we're trying to learn more about and just give people a chance to talk about it and share with us, you know, what's your experience? Are you hearing this happening? What else do you think we should be thinking about? Mm-hmm. And that is a way, it's again, like pretty low lift, but it gives us a much closer sense of just what are people on the ground saying.
Yeah.
But also it just creates transparency for people. So when we then launch a program and it's aligned to something they said, they're like, oh, cool. I said something about that in a meeting and now they have that, you know, let me tell people. So I think it just also builds more of a rapport where people feel like, okay, mm-hmm. they actually listen to what we say and respond to the needs people are bringing up. So I would say, yeah, just like coming up with a couple of low lift recurring processes to stay connected with people rather than like redesigning the one-off all the time can make it a lot simpler.
Exactly. And it goes really beyond the press release. Like you really have to change the culture of the organization sometimes. And I know when I talk about it on the podcast all the time, how I serve on the school board here as well. And we had a superintendent a couple of years ago that was just not about transparency and communication. And then the new superintendent is all about transparency, communication, having public visits, having town halls, you know, meeting with parents and doing coffee hours and things like that. And the whole culture has just changed. And it's just really interesting to see how when an organization does that. And I know it's difficult for a lot of nonprofits because they feel like, oh, we have so much on our plate. We have so much on our plate. How can we possibly add in this one more thing? But I think you're clearly speaking to the benefits. Like, what are some of the benefits that you have seen from incorporating this kind of thinking?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, I mean, even I was at first thinking, it comes up a lot. It's like, okay, is this just going to be like a thing we're doing to check the box that we engage
right,
people?
And you want to avoid that tokenism maybe and
exactly.
That feeling of like, oh, we're just doing this to do it.
Exactly. But then every time we have a board meeting or a listening session, something comes up that is like super helpful and important, even when I don't expect it. So like, for example, you know, we have gone into meetings before to say, okay, hey, you know, we got this request from the school district for a trauma-informed training for all the teachers. We're planning to do it on these days. Do we have approval from the board? And a couple of our board members, you know, are either parents of kids in the school system or they are themselves employed by the school system. And they will tell us stuff like, hey, you might want to know that very recently there's been a lot of gun violence in our community. So that's a particularly sensitive issue. You know, if you're going to do this training, you might want to make sure that your trainers are equipped because that's going to come up.
Right.
And it's like, that's super helpful. We might have not gotten that input and we would have figured it out when that came up in the training, but it's like with that extra voice, it helps us anticipate mm-hmm. some of the challenges or responses that we're going to have and like preempt it. And then if we go into the space acknowledging it off the bat, it's totally different. People are like, wow, they really know what's going on. This training is like a safe space where I can process this thing that's already on my mind. Now they trust us in a very different way. I mean, that's one side of it. And then I think the other side is just that when members of the community feel included, they become ambassadors for us. They yes. are out telling their relationships, hey, I'm on the board of this org. Or like, you know, they might have a friend who says, I don't know, I heard about this event. Do you know who these people are? And they're like, yeah, I actually work with them. I came up with that idea. So it's also a little bit of kind of like marketing almost to keep people
kind of
interested.
Marketing.
Yep.
Amazing. Okay. Now we have to talk about how philanthropy kind of gets involved. because I read your article on Giving Compass. It's called Philanthropy in the Deep South, Know Your Funding History and Share the Wealth. And I think it speaks to a lot of the challenges that rural communities experience, especially communities in the Deep South. And I want to just quote you because I think it's really powerful. You wrote, "Across the Deep South, we see examples of foundations and philanthropists creating complicated grant applications and reporting requirements in order to dole out small sums of money to communities upon whose backs their wealth was built in the first place. Imagine the trauma of applying for funds from a foundation that bears the name of the people that enslaved your ancestors, and then being forced to center the shortcomings of your community in order to convince them that your request is justified." I mean, that just really, really spoke to me, like blew my mind. So what made you write this article? And did you get any pushback from it?
Yeah. Thanks for bringing this up. It's definitely a complicated topic to talk about.
I even think in Boston, this is something that comes up a lot. So even in, you know, Massachusetts, not the Deep South, I think that this kind of this happens a lot. So I would love to hear more of your thoughts on it.
Yeah. So the original inspiration for the story came from so there's an organization called Camelback Ventures, and they explicitly support nonprofits and social enterprises led by women and people of color. And I was a fellow in their cohort several years ago and got a lot of support kind of in the early stages of ROI. And recently they've shifted to also run a fellowship for funders, and they call it the Capital Collaborative. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea is funders who want to better understand how to shift more resources towards people of color who are leading work. Mm-hmm. They can be part of this program, and they kind of have a community around understanding some of the strategies for that. And I'm on the advisory council for that fellowship. And so Camelback actually approached me and said, "Hey, we're doing a series of pieces in Giving Compass, and we want different former fellows of ours to write on a topic." And so when I had that in my head, I was kind of thinking about, you know, we have a lot of different complicated relationships with philanthropy and funding. Mm-hmm. But around that time, one of our funders, which is KP Reynolds Charitable Trust, and it's in the article, but KP Reynolds is like the wife of one of the RJ Reynolds family people. So that's all kind of directly tobacco money. Mm-hmm. I went to their, we get funding from them, and I went to one of their, I think it was like an anniversary convening. And the executive director there, Dr. Laura Gerald, who is from Eastern North Carolina originally, she shared about how the foundation has been putting a ton of effort into understanding the history of the wealth, and that historically they've only told the positive side of KP Reynolds' story, and they mm-hmm. wanted to tell a more balanced truth about her and then use that to inform their strategy. Mm-hmm. It wasn't really about like blaming her or, you know, but more so just understanding. And so they shared, they had hired this historian, and they shared a lot about Kate, both the positive philanthropic things she did, but mm-hmm. also different ways that she and her family contributed to some of the racism and health disparities that the foundation now works to address. Mm-hmm. And the point behind it was just that in order to move towards achieving the goals they actually want to achieve, they have to at some point confront this history. And mm-hmm. she was sharing things like how the foundation was going to divest their endowment from tobacco, or different things like that, that are mm-hmm. pretty radical as far as I've seen in the field. And I just appreciated her openness. Mm-hmm. And so I got really interested in ways that we might be able to use their example to lift up a more common experience we all have. Mm-hmm. And so I actually reached out to the trust and said, you know, can we collaborate on a piece? They agreed. And so we ended up co-writing that article. Mm-hmm. And the first half of it is kind of my experience from the perspective as a person raising funds, and then a little bit of their experience grappling with their own history, and then some of the possible strategies that people can adopt moving forward. And so the idea really was to try to start a conversation, mm-hmm. like, I know just from the number of conversations I've had without asking with community members that there is a lot of historical trauma wrapped up in the history of wealth in our community. Mm-hmm. And none of us were necessarily alive when that wealth was built. So it's not really about blaming people, but there are these long-standing vestiges that still create challenges. Mm-hmm. And in order to heal from or move past that, we have to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so what I wanted was for anybody reading that to be able to privately reflect and say, like, better understand or empathize with the communities that may experience trauma from mm-hmm. philanthropy and wealth disparities, and then think about how they may be connected to it and if or there are ways they could contribute or change practices. And I guess in terms of the pushback question, I mean, for the most part, I got a lot of positive responses. I think a lot of people in North Carolina, but even otherwise, both funders and nonprofit leaders really resonated with the stories and kind of said, you know, this created a helpful starting point for our mm-hmm. organization to reflect or to ask ourselves the question, you know, how did we build our wealth? And, you know, what are ways we might be able to better contribute to the solution, even if we weren't much of a part of the problem? And so that was what I was really hoping to hear and be part of.
Yeah.
I will say there were a couple of funders who reached out and were kind of surprised and wanted to learn more and kind of clarify, like, what did I meant? What mm-hmm. did I mean? You mm-hmm. know, I think people have an experience of being, like, secretly called out. And I think that was bringing yes. up a fear of, like, are you saying something without saying it? Are you calling right. us out? And so that was definitely a thing. And I think, you know, what I appreciated was that they reached out to me about it directly. We were able to have some conversations. Mm-hmm. I was not at all calling anybody out specifically.
It was more the system.
Right. But I think I get that. Like, there's trauma on both sides. And so we have definitely had some conversations about that. But in general, I think it, you know, the goal was to kind of shine a light on something and make it safe for people to start to have this conversation.
Yeah.
So for the most part, I did hear that. I think the one thing that I'll say that's interesting is that, mm-hmm. Like, when you look at the data, less than 3% of all philanthropy goes to rural communities, and even less to the rural majority Black Southeast. Mm-hmm. And this article is a part of that, but it sort of starts to get to maybe some of the patterns behind why that happens. And we got a lot of positive responses, but a challenge or question I still have is what it takes to go from having the conversation to actually shifting resources. And I know that's, like, part of Camelback's aim, but I also am just, I mean, I said it in the article, but also here, just interested in anybody who wants to dive mm-hmm. into the work of going from acknowledgement to actually changing strategy. Like, I would love to be a thought partner or helper in trying to figure out, like, how do we actually change our strategy so that more money is actually being returned to communities.
Do you ever read Vu Le?
Mm-mm.
Oh, so Vu Le, V-U-L-E. Nonprofit AF.com.
I do read Nonprofit AF.
Yeah, that's Vu Le.
Oh, cool.
Yes, everyone needs to read Vu. Yeah, he's incredible. He talks a lot about this, and it actually reminded me of him when I read this. And then community-centric fundraising is also, like, a community-led organization talking about a lot of these issues. And I brought it up only because I think it's such, like, what a sector, what a piece of the sector, foundations and philanthropists that really could benefit from some human-centered design thinking, you know? And that's so interesting to me, the statistic about rural communities. I was going to ask you, like, what are some of the specific and unique challenges in raising money in rural communities?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot. I think a lot of it is just, like, networking and access, like, even us. Mm. So Seth and I think are very disproportionately well connected. We have a ton of resources and privilege. And so it is easier for us. But even then, I just find, I think there are so many more, like, within funders' parameters or guidelines, just very often they are more focused on urban things. And that can come across explicitly or implicitly. So they might, instead of saying we only fund in urban, they might say, you know, we only fund organizations with that serve this many people, or that are ready to scale in this way, or that have budgets of this size. And the reality is, like, the type of impact we're having is less about quantity and more about depth. And so a lot of times they might see our data and say, well, you know, you only serve 100 kids, that, you know, we try to fund things at massive scale. And, you know, for us, 100 kids is a good chunk of the population. Yeah. But getting to that 100 might take more effort, more time, more money. So some of it is just the criteria are often biased. Yeah. And I think also, you know, people don't always know about us, so it's a little bit harder to find the opportunities and build relationships. Funders aren't like coming to events or hosting conferences in our area. Like there's a lot of structural barriers that make it hard to fit into the right boxes. Mm-hmm. And then I think, yeah, I mean, another part of it is that it's kind of this relationship piece where it is easier for us to relate with some of these funders, but I think for people, especially who, you know, who are really doing the work, who have long roots in the community, mm-hmm. it's a lot to ask somebody to reach out and write an application to some of these foundations that have
a
complicated relationship. And especially when they go into it and a lot of the staff is, you know, doesn't reflect the community or might ask, you know, doesn't know that much about it or might ask people like, oh, frame the problem and all the challenges you experience. It's just like a tough process. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of folks are like, you know what? I would rather just earn some revenue or find a different way than jump through all these hoops. Again, this does not speak for all funders, and several of our funders have much simpler, more generous and inclusive processes, but it is on aggregate just asking a lot of organizations that have not had a lot of resources.
Yep. Oh no, absolutely. So what's next for the Rural Opportunity Institute?
Yeah, we're pretty excited. So we are now a full-time team of 4,
oh, great.
Which is exciting. And I feel super good about the team we have on board. And a lot of what we're talking about, basically, how we think about ourselves is we partner with different orgs that already exist in the community to try and help them better understand the community they serve and then design trauma-informed solutions. And so mm-hmm. we're working with like police, school resource officers in particular, schools, healthcare, and to date have had quite a few pretty neat successes in terms of piloting something that's, you know, made a marketable shift in building relationships. Mm-hmm. And so what we're now trying to think about is how do we document and kind of package those things to support other rural communities to do the same thing. And so, like I said, we've done some really good work with like school resource officers, first responders, teachers, social services, and are kind of at the point where we want to connect with other rural departments like that that are also interested in being more trauma-informed and seeing like, okay, does the things that we did here work in those other communities? And so mm-hmm. I think, yeah, in the next year or so, excited to mainly try, I mean, not scale in the like replicate ourselves a million times, but mm-hmm. definitely start to think about like, how do the insights that are coming from our community potentially support other ones that face similar challenges?
Oh, awesome. Okay, so everyone's going to want to get in touch with you. So Vichy, how can people learn more about your work and connect with you?
Yeah, so the easiest is our website, which is ruralopportunity.org. And that has a lot about the different programs we offer. We can do training for organizations or people in trauma-informed practices, but also in human-centered design. And then, like I said, the different programs we've done are kind of summarized there. We are also on LinkedIn, both the org is on LinkedIn, and then I'm personally on LinkedIn, so that's probably a good way to reach out to me personally. And then we're on Instagram, like all the cool kids. So,
how do you use storytelling in your work? I'm just interested.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty powerful. I think we've found that it's pretty powerful to let people tell their own story in a lot of cases. And so, you know, the community board, people like that, we have found different ways to connect them to opportunities. So I think even the Teach for America article, there's, you know, a bunch of different folks that we've worked with kind of contribute. We've created a few testimonial videos that are on our YouTube channel. So we're also on YouTube, where different folks have been able to kind of talk about the ways that healing from trauma have helped them in their work. And something that's been fun that it's relevant to this conversation actually, and something that we've been playing around with is podcasts actually, and specifically for younger folks. So we did one pretty extended engagement with youth a couple of years ago where we, you know, similar design thinking kind of stuff. And what came out really strongly from the youth was they wanted a podcast where they could talk about how their peers experience and deal with trauma, because to them it was like different than adults and doctors and all that stuff. And so we ended up helping students create a podcast where their high school student hosts who interviewed different people in the community. And so it's called The Resilience Zone, and it's on like all the major podcasting platforms and stuff. And so they did two seasons. I think that's been really neat, because instead of us, like, we obviously have some things we specifically want to talk about in our own why and reasons for things. But what's cool about it is that the way that different people in the community experience and interpret and make things their own is often not what we expected.
Yep.
But I think it's, again, like probably a more resonant and useful way for other people to adapt the things that we've been working on. And so I love listening to like how the youth describe the way that resilience tools help them, or hearing how some of our community board members are adapting or using the tools they've learned. So just trying to connect other people to more platforms and opportunities to share their own stories.
Amazing. That sounds great. I will put all of the links in the show notes so everyone can get in touch with you. But wow, this is so fantastic. Thanks so much for being on the podcast and sharing your experiences.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, hey there. I wanted to say thank you for tuning into my show and for listening all the way to the end. If you really enjoyed today's conversation, make sure to subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast app, and you'll get new episodes downloaded as soon as they come out. I would love if you left me a rating or a review, because this tells other people that my podcast is worth listening to. And then me and my guests can reach even more earbuds and create even more impact. So that's pretty much it. I'll be back soon with a brand new episode. But until then, you can find me on Instagram at JuliaCampbell77. Keep changing the world, you nonprofit unicorn.